Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us on WPR News. And today we begin the show by talking about prairie plants and a great guest for you. Neil DeBoe back with us. He's president of Prairie Nursery, co-author of the book, The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants, and certainly recognized internationally as an expert in native plant community ecology. So we'll talk with him about what plants do best with fall planting or seeding, and of course answer your questions as we move along today. What would you like to know about adding natives to your landscape? Are you looking for a recommendation for natives for maybe a specific area? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Neil DeBoe, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Larry, thank you so much for having me on again as autumn creeps forward and promises some opportunities for planting native plants and seeds.
Yeah, for sure. You know, from previous visits with you, we know that some natives do best if planted in the fall versus the spring, and maybe you could expand on why that's the case.
Absolutely, Larry. What you'll find is we have two different ways of planting, basically. One is using transplants, and the other is using seeds. And there are certain plants that are better planted in the fall and some that do better in the spring. And this applies not only to herbaceous prairie plants, but also applies to shrubs and trees. We're going to focus mostly on prairie plants, but there are also then seeds, some of which are better planted in the fall rather than the spring, and some that are better planted in the spring rather than the fall. So let's these are the known knowns and the unknown knowns. Anyway, so we have the plants that do best with fall transplanting as individual transplants. Most of your woodland spring, in fact, all your spring ephemerals, all the early blooming spring plants, which are usually planted as bare root rather than potted plants. And really, frankly, a lot of your spring blooming plants and a lot of your woodland plants actually transplant better as bare root bulbs, rhizomes, etc. And mostly plants that have fibrous roots like grasses and such generally are better planted in the spring. This is a generalization, but of course you can be successful with them in the fall too. But most of your fall wildflowers, they come up early. So you want to have them pre-positioned by placing them in the soil in the fall so they can get a little bit of root growth and establishment in the fall, and then they're ready to jump right out of the ground in the spring, as opposed to putting in like trilliums or jack-in-a-pulpits or things like that in May or even June when they've already halfway through their season. They don't really like that. So it's really best to put especially the spring blooming flowers in the fall. When it comes to seeds, most of your prairie wildflowers and practically all of your woodland wildflowers require exposure to cold, damp conditions in the soil over winter to tell them, I'm anthropomorphizing here, but so that they know that they have gone through winter and they don't germinate in October and then get killed by a hard December cold snap. So many of your prairie flowers and almost all of your woodland flowers do so much better when seeded in the fall as a seed, and they will come up the following spring, with the exception of members of the lily family and a few other families that are what we call double dormant, which is really confounding for gardeners and for propagators, because double dormant means that if you plant them in the fall, they don't come up the next spring like most other wildflowers. They sit in the soil over the summer of the next year, and they go through another winter, and they come up in the second spring. So they're really, really a pain. So it takes them like 18 months from the time that they drop in the summer or fall till they germinate. So it's a year and a half before they show up. So, but they still are best planted in the fall because you want to get them through two winters and one summer cycle so they'll germinate 18 months later. So you don't want to hold on to woodland seeds over the winter and plant them in the spring. Get them in the ground in the fall. This also applies to most of your sedges, which are grass-like plants in the genus Carex, C-A-R-E-X. And there's some beautiful woodland sedges, as well as many wetland sedges, and a few that grow in the open in prairies as well. But a lot of people like to mix woodland sedges with their woodland wildflowers because most of your woodland sedges tend to stay a little bit lower than a lot of your prairie grasses. So they're woodland sedges that can be 6 inches to a foot. Some may get 2 feet or 3 feet. So they make really good companions for your woodland wildflowers. So sed seeds are best seeded in the fall because they also require this exposure to cold conditions over the winter to germinate the next spring.
Very cool. Bill in Minong has a question about some flower seeds, I believe. Let's go there. Bill, hi.
Yeah, good morning. I've been trying to plant wildflowers for my pollinators, and I do have trouble with the township mowing them down after the 4th of July. But other than that, I didn't have any trouble planting my wildflowers in the spring. The lupine came up real good. The mint, I got some beautiful mint for my honeybees. But I was thinking of planting some more this fall, and I guess it'll be a good idea to do it in the fall. Should I work up the soil a little more than normal?
Yeah. Many of the wildflowers, especially prairie flowers, do fine when seeded in the spring. But there are many that do not. There are a few species that will give you zero germination if seeded in the spring, and sit in the soil will hopefully come up the second spring after being in the ground for a year. But there are many wildflowers, prairie flowers like yellow coneflower, black-eyed Susan, bergamot, which is in the mint family, purple coneflower, many of your goldenrods, et cetera, that will germinate fine. And the prairie grasses, and I forgot to mention this earlier, all of your warm season prairie grasses, like little bluestem, big bluestem, Indian grass, side oats grandma, these always do better with seeding in May or June when the soil is warm, because they are warm season grasses. When they are seeded in the fall, there is a significant decrease in their germination the following spring. So it depends on what your goals are. But for your wildflowers, many species will do better. Native species, now I don't know what, if you planted native lupine or if it was a Russell hybrids, there are many different types of lupine. And so it does depend upon the species. But fall planting and fall seeding will usually give you significantly higher germination of most of your wildflowers. Now, as far as site preparation, you want to make sure that all the existing vegetation, weeds, grasses, anything, shrubs or brush, you want to make sure it's been completely eliminated, because these plants can really compete with your seedlings. And especially if you have established grass or weeds and you put seeds in there, that's not a fair fight, because you have established perennials that can basically overtake the seeds that you plant there, and your results will be greatly reduced compared to eliminating everything prior to seeding. And there are many ways to get the site ready. And it also depends on what's growing there. The easiest is a cornfield that's been sprayed to death with Roundup Ready corn or beans. That's the best. Cornfields or bean fields. Okay, so you got all these GMO products, but hey, we can take advantage of the situation because there's very few weeds. So that's your optimal situation. Okay, second best is a manicured lawn. You can just go out there and either treat it, usually just once, with glyphosate or Roundup. If you don't want to do that, you can smother it. Usually for a lawn, it usually takes about 3 months. You can start it in April and keep whatever you're smothering it with on all the way until September, October, and that'll for sure kill it. And then you can seed in the fall, which is an ideal time for your flowers. Or you can till it up, but wow, tilling up a lawn, that's a lot of work, unless you have a rotovator on a tractor and you go across it repeatedly. So there's a number of different ways to do this, but most people either till it, spray it, or smother it. If it's a small area where you want to put in a garden, you can just dig out the sod and remove it. Make sure to shake the good dirt off so you don't lose the really good topsoil. But you want to make sure that everything is killed. All the perennial weeds, grasses, etc., is completely killed before you put down your seed, or it'll be a very difficult row to hoe.
Bill, there you go. Actually, Neil in Madison has a site preparation question as well, I think. Neil, hi.
Yeah, hi there. You may have already answered it, but we have a border between the sidewalk and the road that we were interested in removing what's there and then putting in kind of a low-growing flower lawn product. And the plant that's there now that I'm most concerned about is kind of a bunchy green grass that has really rough leaves to it, or blades to it, I guess, especially when you rub them kind of backwards, and it grows about 6 to 9 inches high if you don't cut it. And it I just want to make sure that I take whatever steps are needed to remove that. It does seem to want to spread to other parts of the lawn too, and so I've been kind of digging it out. So I was just wondering about how to eliminate that, as well as to get the terrace area ready for something else.
Sure. Well, if it's a relatively small area, I assume, on the terrace, how wide and how long is it?
About probably 70 or 80 feet long and about 5 feet wide. Yes.
Okay, 350 square feet. That's quite a task to dig everything out, although it can be done. So if you want to do this organically, you can just go and dig out all the plants and make sure you remove all the root systems, rhizomes, et cetera, so there's nothing left. One of the problems you have when you use this method, if you have quackgrass or smooth brome grass, these are rhizomatous perennial grasses, highly aggressive, and you need to get every single piece of rhizome. Quackgrass, you can have a rhizome a half an inch long and leave it in the soil, and kaboom, there comes a new sprout. And quackgrass can spread 3 feet in radius in 1 year. That's often in the right soil and the right condition. It grows like mad. So you want to make sure you have completely eliminated every root, every rhizome, et cetera, before you put in plants or seeds. And usually on a terrace, I'm assuming you're going to put in transplants. Is that correct, rather than seed?
That I hadn't really decided, but we were thinking about covering it with basically cardboard and wondering if that's effective.
Oh, yes. Cardboard is a great way to do it. Yes. Smothering with cardboard is great. So you'd want to start that basically first thing in spring, like end of March, and keep it on there all year. And that will kill practically all grasses. There are a few species that are really, really tough, and these are the noxious weeds, including Canada thistle, field bindweed, and crown vetch, which is not listed as a noxious weed, but it should be. And these are the three main weeds that we would see in Wisconsin that would be problematic, because you can smother them for a year and it won't kill them. And digging them up is almost impossible, because Canada thistle has roots that can go 18 to 24 inches deep. I have dug that up in what I used for a vegetable garden, and I had to dig down almost 2 feet because I didn't want to use any herbicides. And also interesting, these three plants, the Canada thistle, the field bindweed, and the crown vetch, are resistant to glyphosate. So if you spray glyphosate on them, it's not very effective. And so you have to use broadleaf herbicides if you're going to spray them to kill them. And each one requires its own specific herbicide. For instance, Canada thistle, you can use clopyrrolid or aminopyrrolid on if you have a field bindweed, you need to use Drive, D-R-I-V-E. So you want to make sure and select the right herbicide to kill it, if you're going to do that. But smothering will kill just about everything if you do it from April, early April, through September. You should be in really good shape if it's just grass.
Neil, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Vicki in Edgerton will give you a chance. Hi, Vicki.
Hi. So I have this tall pampas grass that is growing in a ditch, shall we say, or in a ravine in our yard. It's not in the country. It's outside of McFarland. And I need to figure out how to get rid of this stuff and how to dispose of it properly so it doesn't invade someplace else. I mean, right now I've got these long shears and I'm on my knees just chopping it off. But I need to know how to dispose of it and how to get rid of the root systems.
Okay. What you have there, Vicki, is not actually pampas grass. Pampas grass grows on this is a common misconception. Everybody calls it pampas grass, but it's actually maiden grass, which is in the genus Miscanthus, M-I-S-C-A-N-T-H-U-S. And there are many different miscanthi, but you have the one that is commonly planted and creeps along the road, and one little plant looks great, and then pretty soon you got 1,000 plants that maybe you don't want. Okay. So, but anyway, be that as it may, I know what you've got. And it looks beautiful. It has beautiful plumes, but it doesn't really like to stay where it's put. Now, there are many other selections of Miscanthus and species of Miscanthus that don't spread that you can use in an ornamental grass garden. They're not native. They're mostly from Japan and China and Korea, but they're still beautiful, and some of them behave themselves. But how do you get rid of it? Well, do you have any other desirable vegetation mixed in with it, or it's usually just completely takes over everything? Is that correct?
Correct. It's just taking over the ditch.
Okay. So what you can do is, once again, you can go back to the three basic methods. Number one is you can cut everything down and you can smother it, but you're not going to smother that with just plastic because it has big, big shoots that can come up through the plastic. So you're going to put down like multiple layers of cardboard. You may actually want to use plywood. Okay. Okay. I mean, this stuff is tough. Okay. Okay. And you're going to leave it there for at least a year, maybe 2 years. You may find you can get it in a year. Remember, you're starting this in spring before it comes up, so you will never give it a chance to grow. The other option is to go in there with glyphosate, i.e. Roundup, and spray it if you're okay with using herbicides. If you are near a wetland, and this plant typically grows near moist soils, if you are near a wetland, you have to use a different formulation. You can't use Roundup. You have to use Rodeo, which is basically the same ingredient. It's glyphosate, but it has a different surfactant. And the surfactant in Rodeo does not pose a threat to aquatic life, whereas the surfactant in Roundup does. And so it's specifically labeled for use in wetlands. That's Rodeo. Okay. The other choice is get a backhoe in there and dig the whole thing out. Okay. Because, I mean, you can go in there with a shovel, but, man, is that a lot of work. Okay, it has really, really dense roots. You are going to get a super-duper workout. And if there's any sizable area there, you'll tire out pretty fast. It's really got dense roots. So smothering, herbicide, or dig it out, probably with a backhoe.
There you go, Vicky. Thank you so much for calling. Neil DeBow, our guest today as we talk the prairies, prairie plants, prairie seedlings, and prairie seeds. With Neil, he is president of Prairie Nursery and consulting ecologist and co-author of The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk and WPR News. Thanks for listening in today. Hope you can stay with us for the last half hour of the show. We'll have a soil scientist from UW-Stevens Point talk more in-depth about improving and protecting your soil. So looking forward to that. Right now, we're into prairies with our guest, Neil DeBow, the Prairie Nursery. And you can join in the number 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Elizabeth emailed us from Columbia County to ask if you have a no-mow solution for a north facing embankment with dry shade and sandy soil.
Well, yes, we have a very good solution. However, it is not composed of native species. And if you look at native species that grow in dry shade on sand, it is a rather limited palette. And most of your showy wildflowers grow in what we call medium or mesic soils. So your trilliums and your jack-in-the-pulpits and the bluebells and bloodroots, these don't grow in dry sandy soils. And so you really have a dearth of opportunities. So we have a product that I worked with UW Turfgrass Research Station, OJ Nora Turfgrass Station, back in the late 80s and early 90s called our No-Mow Lawn Mix. And it is composed of 5 to 6 different fine fescue grasses, none of which are native to the upper Midwest. I want to make sure everybody knows that. But they grow perfectly well here, and they are an excellent solution for dry sandy soil in shade on a north bank. Now, how much shade? Moderate shade. They will not do well in deep shade, but they will do well in light to moderate shade. In fact, that is the perfect situation. In full sun on dry sandy soils, if you have a dry summer, they can dry out. You will need to water them on dry sand during hot, dry periods in the summer so it doesn't die out. But on the shade, on the north side, it would be extraordinarily rare that you would ever have to water that even during drought. Now, here's the caveat. When you plant this grass or any turf grass in the shade, you have to make sure that you remove the deciduous tree leaves. In fact, pine needles and spruce needles as well. Any tree leaves or needles should be removed, raked off, or collected with a lawnmower or whatever, with a bagger, after they fall in the autumn. Because if you leave them there, they will smother the lawn. And it doesn't matter what kind of lawn it is, it will smother it. And the same is true of the No-Mow Lawn Mix. But, wow, a lot of people up north use this or on their cabins. The last thing you want to do when you go to your cabin, like this weekend, is get out the lawnmower, right?
Yeah.
So you want a lawn that you don't maybe have to mow it once or twice a year. That beats the heck out of every 3 weeks. Okay. And the beauty of this turf is it has a sandy soil. It will get roots that will go a foot deep. Bluegrass usually gets maybe 4 inches deep, so it has tremendous drought tolerance. But as I said, if it's in the hot sun and you have no rain for 3-4 weeks and it's really hot, you can actually kill it. So we'll need augmented watering just during those dry periods. But for dry shade, this is an excellent choice, but not too much shade. If you get like 3/4 of a day of shade, that's about it. Deep shade, no, it won't work well. But make sure that you remove all those leaves in the fall so it doesn't get smothered.
And what was the name of that?
It's called our No-Mow Lawn Mix, and if people want, they can go to our website at Prairie Nursery, PRAIRIENursery.com, and there'll be a whole section at the top when you go to the homepage. It'll say No-Mow Lawn, and there's a ton of information about how to do this. You can go to our resource center, and that will give you a lot of information. It's over on the far right of the website, and you can see there's a download center where you will have a lot of information about prairies, no-mow lawns, et cetera. So tremendous resources there.
Yeah, all kinds of things on that site. That's a, you got a wonderful website there for sure.
Yeah. I should clarify, that's we just changed the name. It's called the Learning Center on the far right of the homepage. And then you go to, there's a whole bunch of information there. So just go to the Learning Center, and we had to keep up with the times, you know. So.
Okay. Well, a huge change to Neil's website there.
Just a different name, that's all. But there's a lot of information there that hopefully people will find useful.
Oh, let's go to Lyman in McFarland. Hi, Lyman.
Hi there. I have a question. I've got a vegetable garden, and I'm thinking it's starting to be too much work. And I was wondering about the possibility of converting just the garden to prairie plants. They are, I have three 25-foot by 4-foot wide strips. Soil is fairly heavy clay soil and alkaline. And I would just like plants that would be, you know, low maintenance, you know, that would thrive in that situation.
Sure. Absolutely. Well, we have, so you have a 25-foot by 4-foot strip and 3M, so you've got 300 square feet total, right? Each one's 100 square foot.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Got it. Yeah. And normally for smaller areas like that, it does make sense to put in transplants rather than seeds. I assume that's what you're thinking of, Lyman. Is that correct?
I don't know. I just want something that would thrive and be low maintenance.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay. Well, you got a couple of choices. You can go with either a seed mix or with plants, transplants. Here's the difference between the two. The transplants will give you, in many cases, if you plant them in April or May, many of them will bloom the year they're installed from our plants that we ship. We ship plants all over. Okay, so many, not all, there are some that are slower growing and will take longer. It might take 2 or 3 or even longer because some of the really long-lived prairie plants may take 4 or 5 years to bloom, but they'll live for decades. I mean, I've got plants that I planted over 40 years ago that are still looking great, some certain species that live a long time. We don't know how long some of these plants live, 100 years? Compass plant? There are a lot of people that think compass plant lives longer than many trees. So we don't have anybody that's lived that long or kept track of it to really know. So kind of need some more data. At any rate, so if you put in transplants, it also gives you control over the layout of the garden. So, and that's one of the things that we touch on in the book, The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants, is one of the concepts to designing a garden and how do you lay out the plants and what plants are appropriate for different areas. We also have information on seed mixes. So you can look at using seeds, but with seeds, the plants are going to come up where the plants are going to come up when you use a mix. Now, you can purchase individual seeds and scatter them here and there so you have little effects like a patch here and a patch there. But you really need to make sure that you include the prairie grasses throughout the entire seeded area because they have the fibrous roots that keep weeds down. And it's really, it's a group effort by all the different plants in the prairie to control weeds. You're going to make the plants do the work for you. That's the beauty of this when done right. Those fibrous roots of the grasses, plus all these different flower roots and the foliage that help to smother out the weeds, work together to keep weeds down. Will it keep it completely weed-free? No, especially in the first few years. You'll have some weeding or some maintenance, usually with mowing with a seed mix in the first couple of years. Now, the plants are faster than the seeds. Seeds usually take 3 to 5 years to really look good. By the third year, they'll really look pretty decent, but it takes 5 years before they really hit their stride. With plants, 2 to 3 years. Okay, and you're really in good shape. The cost, seeds are a fraction of the cost of plants. And the labor, putting down seeds, is a lot less work than putting in plants. So if you're looking at a more budget way to go, then you'd use a seed mix. If you want to control the design of the garden, then you would use transplants.
There you go. Lyman, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Gary in Fond du Lac County, we'll go to you now. Hi, Gary.
Hi there. I got a question regarding our prairie. It's established about almost 25 years with a project with Fish and Wildlife and DNR. But in the last couple of years, we've had a lot of invasion from saplings of willows. And I've been trying to do something with those. I've tried mowing them, but I think that's just making them worse.
So you want to know how to control the willows?
Yeah.
Okay, so obviously you're on the edge of a wetland here. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah, we're about 35 acres wildlife and about the same with woodlands and prairie.
Okay. So how many acres are you dealing with the willow invasion? How much area is affected?
Probably about 10 acres.
10 acres. Oh, boy. Okay. And most willows creep by rhizomes, so you have this invading army coming at you, right?
Exactly.
Yep. Okay. Well, your options are somewhat limited. Probably the most cost-effective method you can use here is fire. And prairies do best under a burning management regime. Unfortunately, the willows have gained control. Have they snuffed out the grasses and the flowers, or are there still grasses and flowers, prairie grasses and flowers underneath the willows?
There are still some better in some places than others.
Okay.
But there are some.
There are some
places where the plants are snuffed out.
Okay. So in order to carry a fire, you need the fine fuels represented by the prairie grasses. So willows themselves, if you have a 20-mile-an-hour wind, you can get them to burn probably, but maybe not. You don't want to burn in a 20-mile-an-hour wind. That's usually not recommended. I've done it, but not recommended. So you would need pretty much a good stand of grass in order to burn those willows back to the ground. This is not going to kill them, but it will remove the top growth and reduce them to individual stems or lower growing stems the next year, because they will resprout from the ground. You're not going to kill them. Okay. So, but if you don't have any grass, you won't have any fire. So the fire will be limited in areas where you have just solid willows. You can cut down the willows, go in there with a brush mower or woods mower and cut everything down, brush hog, and then let it resprout the next year. And maybe there are some grasses in there that will recover once you remove the canopy of the willows. That will give you some more fuel, hopefully, but we don't know that until you do it. Okay, but it will not eliminate them. But what you also can do is you can cut them down without fire. Instead, if you can't burn it, then you just go and cut them to the ground. And this is interesting. Generally speaking, if you want to harm woody vegetation, the best time to cut woody vegetation usually is in late July or early August, because that's when they're actively growing. You don't want to do them when they're dormant because they don't have any leaves on them. You want to hammer these things. So you want to get them when they're cooking. Okay, so you go out there in midsummer and mow them to the ground. And then let them come back, and then mow them again when they resprout, which would probably be sometime in late September or mid to late September. So if you do like a mid-July and a mid-September mowing, you're going to hurt those willows. You're not going to kill them. Okay. Now, the next spring, they're going to resprout. Okay. If you have areas where you've got decent prairie, if the willows are taller than your prairie plants, and they will usually grow up pretty well in the new year, or you might have to wait until the second year, you can go in with what is called a wick applicator herbicider with glyphosate on it. Or you can use a woodland, a broadleaf, which is also specifically designed for killing willows, or a combination of the two. The wick applicator is on a bar. It has like a foam on it, and you just drive a tractor with this applicator behind it, fed by herbicide that will then put herbicide on the leaves of the willows. This would be sometime in June, latter part of June, before the prairie grasses flowers get high, so they're not affected by this. And you don't want the wick applicator dripping. You just want it to put that herbicide on the leaves of the willow stems above the prairie plants. And that is how you can kill the willows. This is a fairly involved process, and you have to find the right equipment. But they're not terribly expensive. You can get these wick applicators for a few $100. Okay. So that is one way that you could attack this, because you do not want to go out there stem by stem, because you're never going to make any progress, and you're going to a knife fight with a pillow in your hand. So, okay. And even fire, even intense fire, will not kill the willows. They'll resprout, so you're not going to get rid of them. So assuming that you're okay with using herbicide, and if you're in a wetland, you do have to use Rodeo, not Roundup or equivalent, with a different surfactant, so you don't damage any aquatic life. So that's going to be your most logical, easiest, large-scale method to get that willow under control. And I can assure you, you're not going to kill them all the first time you do this. They're going to come, some will come back. So you're going to mow them down after they die, and they're going to come back the next year, and you're going to go back there and hit them at least a second time, maybe a third time. But you'll get real results using this method.
There you go, Gary. Good luck, and thank you very much for calling. Well, let's go to Mary in Gays Mills next. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I was listening and hearing your advice on getting rid of Canada thistle, and I have another suggestion, which an organic farmer friend gave me, and it worked very well, and that was to plant the area with sorghum Sudan grass. And whenever the grass gets to be about a foot tall, then mow it, and do that at least three times during the summer. And the thistles couldn't keep up.
Wow. So three mowings did it, huh?
Wow. That seems amazing. You sure they were Canada thistle?
Well, they were tall thistles.
Oh, they were tall.
Okay.
Now, when you say tall, how tall was tall? Because Canada thistle usually doesn't get more than 3 or 4 feet tall, and your bull thistle and your nodding thistle will get 6 feet tall.
Okay. These were more 4 feet tall. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. And the Canada thistle forms these patches, whereas the others are individuals. Because the bull thistle and the nodding thistle are biennials. They don't normally present a long-term problem in a prairie or a garden, but the Canada thistle does because it's perennial and rhizomatous. So this is really interesting. So they planted sorghum Sudan grass probably, what, in late May, early, mid-May?
It was in the spring, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And then when did they mow it? What stage?
When the grass gets to be a foot tall.
Okay, so when the sorghum grass is 1 foot tall, they mowed it to the ground?
Yep.
Okay, and then they let it regrow, and the sorghum Sudan never got more than a foot tall?
Right.
Wow. Okay. Wow, fascinating.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. So three times, three mowings did it, and then the Canada thistle was gone.
But I would say at least 90% were gone.
Okay. Well, that's pretty darn good.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, that's really interesting. Wow, thank you.
Thanks, Mary. That's amazing.
That is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, I had not heard of that method before, and that's why I asked right away if it was she was sure it was Canada thistle.
Because, yeah, it sure sounds like it. 3 to 4 feet tall. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's almost certainly it. Yeah.
Mary, thank you very much for that suggestion and that tip. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. Terry in Wauwatosa and Cable, he emailed to say he bought a slew of Joe Pye weed several years ago. This year was a shock. He has 7 to 8 foot Joe Pye weed taking over 3 flower beds. Looks fantastic, but enough is enough. How far back should he cut or trim to reduce the volumes? Is transplant a possibility? Can he move some from Milwaukee County to Bayfield County?
Yes. He says Joe Pye weed. I don't know if this is the Joe Pye weed Eupetorium maculatum, which is commonly called spotted Joe Pye weed or Joe Pye weed, or the tall Joe Pye weed, which is Eupetorium. Well, they keep changing the name. Eupetorium altissimum now. And that can get 10 feet tall. I have that in my yard. And it likes to kind of move around by seeds, surprisingly. And it's not even native to my area. So this is a case of a plant that I got from northern Ohio and planted in central Wisconsin. And it's become a little bit of a pest in a little way. But that's okay. It gets in my lawn, and I let them grow because the butterflies love them. But anyway, to answer the question, yes. If it's a regular spotted Joe Pye weed, absolutely you can move it from Milwaukee to Bayfield because it grows up in northern Wisconsin. If it's the tall Joe Pye weed, it is probable that you can because Bayfield, I grow it here perfectly well. Bayfield actually has a growing season that is 30 days longer than my growing season in central Wisconsin because of the lake and the bay, Shawamigan Bay. So as far as the extreme temperatures, it gets a little colder in Bayfield, but I would be surprised if he couldn't grow the tall Joe Pye weed up there as well. So moving that would probably work. And besides, we don't get the kind of weather we used to get up there anymore. So how do you control it? You can cut it back in June, and it will multi-fork in stems. We do this with asters, because asters, like New England aster, can get 6 feet tall. cut it back in June, and it will send up side shoots, and so it'll only get 3 or 4 feet tall. So you can do the same thing with Joe Pieweed, and it should recover perfectly well. The other choice is to just strip off the lower leaves, if you want, so it doesn't shade out other plants below it, which allows you to still enjoy the beautiful blooms of the Joe Pieweed when they're blooming in August. So there's a couple different strategies here, or you can just find them a new home and get them the heck out of there.
Okay. There you go, Terry. Good luck. Appreciate the call. Christy in Chippewa County, your turn. Hi, Christy.
Hi, thanks. I have a large patch of full sun, really hard sand. I'd like to plant native prairie nursery seed. It's been herbicided for a full 2 growing seasons. It's just totally impervious. It's like the bottom of the barrel from a sand and gravel company, unfortunately. And then also, we're in a heavily infested deer area, and basically the Monarda's being left alone. And any suggestions on the deer? I'll listen. Thanks.
Okay. Well, hang on, Christy. Can I ask you a couple questions?
Yes.
You there? Yeah. So you said, can you describe the soil in a little more detail? You said it was hard sand. Did I understand you right?
Yes. It's like I'd have to stand on a shovel and jump, and you might get a quarter inch to respond.
But it's sand, not clay?
It is not clay. I'm Lafayette, and we are sand. But I know what
really
you're getting at. Because, yeah. You know, I haven't had it soil tested. There must be there's something in there, because sand would give away like a sandy beach.
Yeah, there's got to be either some clay in there or a rock right underneath it.
Yeah, that's possible too.
Oh, okay. It sounds like you have a serious compaction problem. What is, do you know the history of the area, Christy?
Well, it's on top of Lafayette sand, which is glacial outwash. And this sand I paid from a sand and gravel guy up on 64 and 124. And I thought it was good because it looked dark when it came in the dump truck. And lo and behold, I planted Nomo 2 years ago in some of the same stuff. And it is growing. It's surviving.
Yeah.
I'm amazed that it's even surviving. Okay. How much area are you dealing with here, Christy?
100 by 50.
100 by 50. Okay. Well, normally what we would do with a compacted situation like that is we have a two-step program where we would go in there and deep till it as far as we could. First of all, you want to get a pickaxe, okay, and dig into that and see what the heck is down 6, 8, 12 inches deep, okay? You're going to need a pickaxe, but it sounds like, okay? Shovel isn't going to do it, okay? And look and see what's in that soil, because remember, prairie plants have deep roots. Some may only be a few inches deep, but many of them will go 5, 6, 7, 8, 10, 12, 15 feet deep. So we need to know if they have a hope of growing in this site, okay? So let's go down in the top foot and see what's going on. Is there just a zone of compaction at the top and then the soil is fine underneath? Or is there a problem deeper than that? So first and foremost, get a pickaxe and go down and dig a hole and really look at that soil. And you can tell compacted soil because you'll see these layers. You can see almost these lines in the soil that shows you where the compaction has occurred in most cases, okay? And I'm going to guess there's more than sand in this, or else it wouldn't compact so badly. But you'll find out when you dig in here. Once you know how deep it is, then the next choice is to come in with a tractor rotavator and just grind it up as deep as you can go. Most rotavators can go 6 to 7 inches, maybe 8, okay? So, and just go across it many times to break all that up, and then you need to add organic matter. Because if you don't have organic matter in there, it's going to be a tough row to hoe, because you want to open that soil up, and organic matter is the best. So if you can bring in some leaf compost or any kind of compost and put like 3 inches on top and rotovate that in and mix it in. Then put another 3 inches and rotovate that in. Now you've got the equivalent of 6 inches mixed into the 6 inches of the depth that the rotovator will go. Now you got a shot at actually getting some root growth in this soil. Now you're ready to seed.
There you go. A little bit of work there, Christy, but all the rotovators there, I mean, there takes a little time, but you're not having to apply a lot of physical pressure of your own.
Oh, when I mean rotovator, I mean this is like a 6 to 7 foot wide machine that goes on the back of a tractor.
Yeah,
this is not your Troy build. Oh my God, you know what? Believe me, I've done it, and the Troy build, it just bounces off and it starts running away from you. Okay, have you ever done it where it ran away and then it goes into the fence and wrecks the fence and grinds up the fence? Oh yeah, been there, done that. Yeah, I mean it literally runs away from you on those tines. It's like, no, you want a rotovator on a tractor, and otherwise You'll have a hell of a time on what Christy is describing. Oh, my God. Get the Roto-Rooter, please.
Christy, good luck. Thank you for calling. Neil DeBull, president of Prairie Nursery, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk and WPR News. Great to have you along today for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here talking prairies and prairie plants with Neil DeBull, president of Prairie Nursery and co-author of a great book. It's titled The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants. And callers online, so let's go to the phones here. Jerry and Madison, thank you for calling.
Hello.
Hi, what can we do for you?
Well, howdy, Neil. This is an exciting summer because it's the first one where my compass plants and my prairie dock have bloomed profusely.
Excellent.
I finished harvesting all the seed for the compass plants, and I'm waiting on the prairie dock seed, but it's good 9 feet. I also harvested lots of seed for showy onions and for yuccas, all volunteers. So, curious, when's the best time to go ahead and try to plant these?
Well, you can plant these now if you want, Jerry. They'll sit in the soil and come up next spring. And most of your species in the genus Silphium, which is, of course, the compass plant and the prairie dock, and also your cup plant and rosinweed, these will benefit from fall seeding because they will be exposed to the cold, damp conditions in the soil to break dormancy. I have never grown yuccas, so I can't speak to that, but onions also do much better when seeded in the fall to break dormancy in those seeds. I'm guessing yucca would probably perform the same way, although I have no experience with that.
There you go, Jerry. Thank you very much for calling. Sandra in Wisconsin Dells. Hi.
Hi. Neil, my question's regarding transplanting established prairie plants because I purchased plants from you 2 years ago. They're doing great, but I made the mistake when I laid out my little prairie garden that towards the front of it, I have these huge giant hyssop plants, and I want to move them to the back. I was, I was like, oops, they look really good this year, but wow, they're like 6 feet tall.
Everything is giant this year from all this rain in the spring.
Yeah. Can I move them? Is that something possible to do?
Oh, yeah. Yes, there are some prairie plants that you can move once established, and there are some prairie plants that you cannot successfully move. And it's pretty basic and simple. If you look at the different root types, it's all driven by their roots, okay? If you have a fibrous-rooted plant, like a grass, okay, they have dense fibrous roots. Many of your flowers have fibrous roots, whereas other plants have tap roots, like your compass plant and your prairie dock that Jerry was just talking about, and purple prairie clover and white prairie clover and pale purple coneflower and butterfly weed. These have tap roots. They are virtually impossible to move successfully when they are mature. You'll just kill them. Okay. In fact, what you do, I've seen people cut the top foot off of a compass plant of the big mature root and plant it. Of course, it dies, but then the root that's still in the ground will come up with a new sprout from a foot deep because most of the root's down in the ground. And well, you can't guarantee that, but it does happen. So tap roots, no way to move them. Again, unless you have a backhoe and you can go 5 feet deep, then you got to dig a 5 foot deep hole. You know, it's like transplanting a tree. So, but fibrous rooted plants, and then you have bulbs and corms. So things like the blazing stars, these are corms, which are bulb-like or roots. Those are super easy to transplant. You just dig them up in the fall, and fall is the best time to do it, or very early spring before they sprout, and you can move them with impunity. Your grass is easily dug, and many can be divided. And hyssop has a fibrous root system, so it's very easy to dig, and you might be able to divide some of it depending upon the structure of the root and how large it is. Time to do it. Make sure the plant is dormant. There are some plants you can move when they're growing. Irises. You can't kill irises. They're bulbs. You dig them up in the middle of summer, cut them back halfway, stick them in the ground. They're like, woo-hoo, I'm fine. Other plants are very sensitive, like shooting star. If you dig up shooting star when it's actively growing in the spring and transplant it, without keeping all the soil around it, you'll probably kill it. So it all depends upon the species, which is why the general rule of thumb is move plants when they're dormant. Many do well in the fall. Some do fine in the early spring before they come up. So look at the roots. And that's one of the things in our book, the Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants, we make sure to list the root type. That's very important. So then you can look in there and say, oh, it's a taproot. I can't move it. Oh, look, it's a bulb or a corm. I can move it. So that's kind of the general rule of thumb of moving plants.
You know, Sandra, thank you very much for calling. And Ty had emailed to ask what guidebook you'd recommend for native prairie plants found in southwest Wisconsin. And something like that would be in your book, I think.
Yes. Now, again, we only have 148 species of flowers and grasses, so it's not going to be inclusive of southwestern Wisconsin. There is an outstanding book. And let me get the name of that. Hang on just a minute. It's in here in my bookshelf. Why can't I find it? Here we go. It is called Wildflowers of Wisconsin and the Upper Midwest. That's Wildflowers of Wisconsin and the Upper Midwest. And this is by Merrill, M-E-R-E-L, Black, like the color, and Emmett, E-M-M-E-T, Judziewicz. That's J-U-D-Z-I-E-W-I-C-Z. But I think all you have to do is look for Wildflowers of Wisconsin in the Upper Midwest. And what's beautiful about this is it shows range maps for many of the species. So it'll show you what counties it's in Wisconsin. And it has it specific
perfect.
To Wisconsin. So it's really, really good. Our book also shows range maps for the United States, but it's not as easy to read the counties as the Wildflowers of Wisconsin and the Upper Midwest. Now, this is wildflowers. It doesn't include grasses, but it will certainly get you the vast majority of species that are found in our prairies in southwestern Wisconsin. It's a great book.
Good. Chris in Madison, have you got a question for us?
Hello. Yeah, I do. I have found a plant that I have identified, you know, on Google, and I think it's snake root. And it's kind of growing on the perimeter of our yard, mostly coming in from the neighbor, and I just wondered a good way to get rid of that stuff.
Okay, now when you say snake root, is it white snake root, black snake root, or a different snake root? There are many snake
roots. Well, the flower, the little flowers are white. They grow about 3 to 4 feet tall, and they kind of grow in a clump, you know?
Yep. Okay, yep.
Okay.
Okay, so it sounds like you've got our native Eupatorium rugosum. Just so you know, R-U-G, oh, Eupatorium. Oh, actually, I think they changed the name to Eupator adolphus. I don't know. They keep changing the names. But if indeed it is what it sounds like, Eupatorium or Eupator adolphus rugosum. Yeah, this is kind of a weedy native woodland plant. When I say weedy, meaning that it moves around. And I have it on my property. And some years it blooms profusely, and other years it's not real common. And it likes to invade my woodland gardens. So how do you get rid of it? It's easy to pull. Do you have a lot of it or just a little bit of it?
Well, kind of not a ton of it, no.
Okay. The easiest, quickest method, if you don't have a lot of it, is to go out there with a trowel and dig it out. Okay, that way that ensures that you get the roots. You want to make sure you get all the roots. It comes up really easily because it has shallow root systems, shallow fibrous root systems that are easily removed. That's what I do on my property. I just pull it up. But sometimes when you pull it, it breaks off, so that's why you'll need a trowel in order to remove all of the roots so it doesn't come back next year.
So apply a little pressure there with a trowel, and you should be in good shape. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, by the way. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Our guest today, Neil DeBull, president of Prairie Nursery, consulting ecologist. He is co-author of The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants, and he is going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. We'll be taking a quick look at the news, and then we will be back with Neil. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk. We'll be right back.
Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk as we talk prairies with our guest, Neil DeBoel, president of Prairie Nursery, a consulting ecologist. His book, The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants. We have callers online, so I think, Neil, we'll just go back to the phones here, and Jim in River Falls, who has a question. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Thank you for having me on. Yeah, I was just wondering if Neil had any new tips for trying to control raspberries. I burned my prairies this spring, and I know it's not really the right time, but when they, you know, the raspberry plants, when I could see them because all the stuff was burned off, I brushed on, straight triclopyr. That really didn't affect them too much in the spring of the year. I know fall is better, but just wondering now, it's probably going to be harder to see them, if there are recommendations I should use triclopyr or there's something else, if I can, spraying would be a little easier than brushing on, but looking for recommendations, the easiest and most effective way to try to control them.
Yeah, raspberries are the worst. Well, not the worst, but they are really tough. And it's interesting, some of our native plants are some of our worst weeds. The worst weeds in my prairie are raspberries, black walnuts, and Canada goldenrod, all native plants. The squirrels plant the black walnuts, and the raspberries just seem to come. You know, it's a great wildlife food. It's fantastic. But if you don't want it in your prairie, it's a real pain. Now here, let's look at the genus Rubus. Okay, so you have all these different raspberries, blackberries, dewberries. They're all in the genus Rubus. So they creep by rhizomes, and the previous year's stems die, and they have new stems that bear the fruit. Okay, so when you go to cut them, you're going to cut a dead one and a live one. Okay, or two dead ones and two live ones, whatever. How do you get rid of it? Yes, you can use herbicides, but I can tell you this. If you're using glyphosate, Roundup, if you spray them before they are in the berry stage, it's just going to bounce off. It might kill the leaves, but they'll come right back. I don't know if that's the same with triclopyr or other broadleaf herbicides or silvicides. I have used two methods for controlling it myself. Burning, of course, just burns it back, but it comes back. You'll never kill it. So you either get down on your hands and knees in the fall with a pair of pruning shears, and you cut each stem at the ground, and you put a drop of your preferred herbicide. I use concentrated glyphosate because I don't want to use broadleaf herbicides if I can avoid it. It's also cheaper. Maybe two or three drops, just a little bit. I'm able to use just a little bit, and there's no chance of collateral damage from a spray. I never spray in my prairie with glyphosate because you'll kill anything. Okay? But that's time-consuming. So what I did this spring on my prairie where it's at the edge of the woods, and that's where the raspberries come in. I just went out there. It's like one day I'm out there like, oh, I think I'll pull these. So there I was without any gloves, pulling the raspberries and digging them up out of the ground. I should have had a dandelion digger, but no, Neil's going to do this like an animal and pull them out of the ground. And this is how you toughen up your hands for the summer. Okay. You got to go out there and pull the raspberries by hand and dig them up by hand with no gloves on. Is that stupid? I mean, that's why they call me Neil Anderthal. Okay. What a nut. Okay. So, but if you're smart, you'll go out there with a dandelion digger. Okay, so you don't wreck your hands or toughen your hands up too much. It really does work. And then you just dig them out and follow the rhizomes. You're not going to get them all, but you will get so many of them that you come back next year and you'll see that if you did a good job, there'll be very few left where you dug them out. And once you get them all gone, then you're in shape until the damn birds go in there and sit up in the burr oak you put in your prairie that dropped the seeds. So now you got more raspberries, and that's where they are, under the burr oak that I planted in the prairie. Like, duh, why did I plant that burr oak? But so no good deed goes unpunished.
Jim, there you go. There's the way to do it. Russ in Athens, we'll go to you now. Hi, Russ.
Hi. I've got the north side of my house, so it's shaded most of the day, trying to find something I can plant in there that wouldn't necessarily have to be mowed because it doesn't dry out, especially this summer. I could just about grow cattails in there. But really heavy soils. I've got 12 to 18 inches of heavy black dirt and then clay as deep as you want to dig.
Okay. And where are you located again, Russ?
Athens.
Athens? Okay,
west,
got it.
Boston Marathon County.
Okay. Yep. Okay. I suggest ferns. These are bulletproof, and you want big ferns. Can you handle something that's 4, 5, 6 feet tall?
For sure. Yeah, in that area, for
sure. All right. Yep. Okay. So for the north side of a house, you want something that's really low maintenance, really tough, long-lived, keeps most weeds out. Go with the ferns. And let me give you some suggestions here, okay, because it's wet clay, okay? So here are your choices for wet clay. Sensitive fern, which is the lower growing of all, okay? And cinnamon fern, and royal fern. These all tolerate wet clay. The cinnamon fern will get about 4 feet tall. The royal fern can get 6 feet tall. Cinnamon may go 5 feet. Okay, it depends. Okay, if it's not super wet, you can also put in interrupted fern. Okay, but that likes a little better drain soil. If it's really wet and clay, I would be careful on the interrupted. But the cinnamon, the sensitive, and the royal fern, these are some heavy hitter dudes. Now, don't make the mistake in a confined area. Another fern that will grow there and do great is called ostrich fern, okay? But ostrich fern creeps by runners. And if you want this to stay in the spot, you will rue the day you plant ostrich fern in an uncontrolled situation like a box, okay? If you have a hillside, a moist hillside that needs stabilization, plant ostrich fern. I used it on one of my hillsides in a ravine. Oh, my God, it just worked like a dream. But there's room for it to run, and I don't care if it kind of impinges on its neighbors, okay? So ferns are really ideal, and you can put them like 2-3 feet apart. You don't need a lot of them because they're going to spread out depending on the fern that you choose. So make sure and pay attention. On our website, we list the spacing. So usually 1 to 3 feet depending on the fern, but these guys are big, so you're looking at 2 to 3 feet apart. Does that help?
Yes, it does.
All right.
All right. Excellent. Good luck.
Yeah, thanks, Russ. Appreciate the call. Jules emailed to say that the comfrey they planted is taking over their garden.
Surprise, surprise, surprise.
Yeah. How do I get rid of it or control it? Is
Larry,
the question.
Larry, you know more about this than I do. I don't know nothing about no comfreys. I'm sorry. That's outside my area of expertise. Hey, let's just Google it.
Yeah, I have no, honestly don't know either. That's not a question that I've really come up for me.
Yeah, I know that it can become aggressive. I myself have never grown it, but okay, here's all, you know, I'm going on the internet where everything is true, okay? Digging out the roots or chopping down the sprouts before they develop leaves. But I'm sure that you would have to do that repeatedly.
Yes.
Every time the leaves come back, chop them down until the plant has basically exhausted all of its energy. You know, I threw an old horseradish root in my compost pile. Well, that thing's there for life. Okay. And now there's more of them. So I've got horseradish grown in my compost pile, and it keeps multiplying. It's like, okay, you're good. I just dig around it.
Oh, man.
So I honestly don't know anything about comfrey. I'm just looking online here, and it says you can dig it out by the roots or, you know, cut it back every month until you exhaust the roots.
Well, tell you what, let's try something else. How about cinnamon ferns? Susan in Sturgeon Bay emailed she wants to plant cinnamon fern and Goldie's fern on the north side of her house, wondering when to plant them.
She can plant them either in September or, and she's in Door County, you know, she's got spring until June 15th. So, you know, May or June would be a great time to put those in. So she can put them in September or May or June. By putting them in September, she has a somewhat extended season there because it's out into the lake and the bay. So it'll give more time for those plants to get established before it gets cold if she puts them in the fall. And then the other option is to put them in mid-spring.
Barb in Elroy has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Barb.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I live on a hill, and I am in the process of getting rid of invasive species and planting wildflowers and native grasses. I get a lot from Prairie Nursery. My question is, what can I do to keep the grasses and the flowers from falling over? The hill is, I guess, steep enough so that even my cup plant falls over and I have to tie it up and stake it. I have to tie up my Indian grass and stake it. And as I develop it, that's a lot of tying and staking.
Yes. Okay. So what direction does your hill face?
It faces east, but it's open, so I get a lot of all day.
Okay, so it faces east, and you have nice loamy soil there in Elroy, I assume?
No, I have clay.
Oh, you have clay. Okay, heavy clay. Okay, all right. The problem here almost certainly is excessive nitrogen. I'm assuming you don't put any fertilizer on it, right?
Not in the native gardens yet.
Okay, good. Because when plants get tall and floppy, that's usually due to lots of nitrogen. Now, this year, it was due to lots of rain. Okay. Does it do this every year, or is it just doing it this year?
Every year. And I've been gardening, okay. I've been gardening with grasses for quite a number of years.
Okay, got it. Okay. You probably have excessive nitrogen. That's my guess. And so what you can do to counteract this is you can add, it's going to sound crazy, but you can spread sawdust onto your soil. Like, put down 2 inches of sawdust every spring. And why sawdust? Okay. Because sawdust has a high carbon to nitrogen ratio and much higher than the average in organisms. Like people, our carbon to nitrogen ratio in our bodies is like 18 to 1 or 20 to 1. Plants are similar. So by adding all this carbon to the ground, then the soil organisms will suck up nitrogen preferentially to plants to decompose that organic matter, that high carbon organic matter in the sawdust. So you're creating a condition that in sandy soils would be called nitrogen depression, where if you add sawdust to a sandy soil, which is inherently low in nitrogen, you can make it so low in nitrogen that plants can't grow there or have a very difficult time growing. In your rich clay soil, you add the sawdust so that you can hopefully reduce the level of nitrogen that's available to plants by having the soil microorganisms, bacteria, fungi, actinomycetes. They are eating up that carbon and using the nitrogen in the soil because they can access it more efficiently than the roots of the plants. I can't guarantee you this will work, but give it a try for 3 years. Put down 2 inches of sawdust for 3 years in a row and see if that doesn't help your problem.
Yeah. Barb, give it a shot. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it.
Barb, make sure you don't use black walnut sawdust, okay?
Yeah.
Okay, oak, pine, maple. Use sweet sawdust. Sweet sawdust like maple or, well, elm. Some people still have elm trees. Birch, but don't use black walnut. You can use oak. I would steer clear of pine, and definitely don't use spruce because it has all sorts of weird chemicals in it. So I hope that helps.
All right. Thank you, Barb. Christy at Appleton emailed. She has a native plant garden that is about 4 years old. It's going well, but the rabbits ate her asters down to the ground. And she had heard on Garden Talk that the rabbit population is higher this year, and it seems to be. She's going to try and protect them better next year, but if there was no or minimal foliage growth this year, will it come back?
That's a good question. That depends on how many times the asters came up and were eaten by the rabbits. If it was just a single event, then the asters would have been expected to resprout after being eaten. But if they resprout and get eaten, resprout and get eaten, resprout and get eaten repeatedly, then eventually it will exhaust the energy of the roots and can kill the plant, just like when we were talking about the comfrey, cutting it back every month to exhaust the roots. So it depends on how many snacks were had by the rabbits. And so if it was just one snack, the asters should be fine. But if it was multiple snacking, that could be problematic. So, yeah, rabbits. I have seen rabbits on our property. We never have rabbits because we have lots of raptors and coyotes, so we almost never see rabbits. But this year we had lots of rabbits, so it seems to be some kind of upcycle in the populations.
Kent in Reedstown emailed. He plans to use fecon equipment to cut 3 acres of dogwood. He hopes the blue stem that is moving into the dogwood area will take over. Any advice for helping this along?
When in doubt, burn it. Because the blue stem, being an herbaceous plant, is benefited, a herbaceous prairie plant, is greatly benefited. Now, he didn't say if it was big blue stem or little blue stem, but I'm guessing it's big blue stem because if the dogwood, I'm assuming the dogwood is gray dogwood, which is an invasive rhizomatous native. Great plant for creating dense cover and habitat, but it likes to take over, as opposed to the red osier dogwood, which is just individual plants, although it can spread by seeds. But either way, the woody plants are harmed by fire because it burns their stems back. It won't kill them, but it burns their stems back. So they only grow back 2, 3, 4 feet in a year, which allows the big blue stem, hopefully, assuming it's big blue stem, to grow up over them and to get a little more sun and to maintain at least some level of dominance. But that means that you're probably going to have to burn this every other year, possibly every year, depending on how vigorous the dogwood growth is. So it's going to be a regular process of burning. And when you're doing regular burning, you want to make sure you have a fire break, a permanent fire break, all the way around the area to be burned, whether that fire break is an existing river or lake or sidewalk or road or a mowed strip of grass. And when I say a mowed strip of grass, if you have big blue stem, you want a 20-foot wide mowed strip of grass because big blue stem burns hot. And you won't even be able to get within 50 feet of that when it's burning. So a 20-foot mowed strip all the way around it of grass. And mow that strip in the fall and mow it as close to the ground as you can. Go in there in November and mow it down because then all the flammable material that was in that grass firebreak will rot over the winter and it will not be flammable in the spring when you go to burn it. So that's really important.
Really important. You mentioned big blue stem, of course, and Stephen Osceola harvests big blue stem seed every year and usually sows it in the fall, and then he heard you say it'll be better if you do it in the spring. How do you suggest he store the seed over the winter?
Very simple. To store seed, you want to keep it cool and dry. And your prairie plants generally need exposure to cold conditions to break dormancy. Grass is the warm season grasses, like big blue stem, little blue stem, Indian grass, switchgrass, Psittos grama. They only need exposure to dry and cold conditions, unlike many of your wildflowers that need to sit in the soil and absorb moisture under what we call cold moist stratification. Stratification being the exposure to cold over the winter. It's an old term when people used to put seed in layers of sand to break dormancy, and they called that strata, hence the name stratification. But anyway, so what he can do is make sure that his seed is completely dry. I'm not sure how he's drying it, but make sure it is utterly dry so there's no moisture in it. And then he can store it in plastic bags once it's dry, or he can store it in canvas bags. A lot of people put their seed in canvas bags. And then put it out in an unheated building or a garage in a steel trash can or a plastic trash can that completely seals so the mice don't get in it. Okay, because the mice will go in there and make all sorts of nests and eat the seeds. And then you can plant that in May or June because big blue stem and your warm season prairie grasses germinate basically at the same time as corn. They're very closely related to corn in many ways. So when the farmers are planting corn, that's the time to plant your warm season prairie grasses, usually early to mid-May. But you can plant them all the way up to the end of June. In fact, I planted a little blue stem into mid-July. As long as it rains, you'll be okay.
And here's something that relates to this, I believe. Liz in Fox Lake emailed. She's a volunteer for the Dodge County Healthy Soils, Healthy Waters Alliance. She collects native seeds from her native garden every year and gives them to farmers to help farmers attract pollinators. She puts them in paper bags stored at room temp in her home, then gives to the farmers in the fall. The farmers report the seeds are not germinating, and she wonders why. She assumes the farmers are preparing their plots appropriately. Does she need to clean the seed first? If so, how? And she's got prairie drop, little blue stem, purple coneflower, butterfly weed, red swamp milkweed, et cetera.
Okay, so she's in Fox Lake, but some of the plants that she's growing typically grow in drier, sandier soils. The soils in Fox Lake are typically silt loams, which are heavier soils. So plants like butterfly weed, little blue stem, they do okay on loam, but you get into a silty clay loam, it really doesn't tend to compete very well. So that might be part of the problem, is the species may not be matching up to the soils, assuming that I'm correct in my analysis of the soil. I live 15 minutes from Fox Lake, so I have a pretty good idea what the soils are. They have really nice soil. So that could be a factor. Also, if the seed is not cleaned, you don't really know what the content is or how much actual viable seed there is. So you may be overestimating the amount of viable seed without actually cleaning it and testing it. And, of course, every seed test costs between $50 and $100, depending upon what kind of test you're doing. So that may or may not be worth it. So, and then what method is being used for cleaning? What method is being used for seeding? And is there proper post-planting, post-seeding management? And if you don't cut the weeds down in the first couple of years to keep them from overtaking the prairie plants, it doesn't matter how good the seed is or how well you prepared the site, although site preparation is everything, you have every step of the way. You have the site preparation, the seeding method, the quality of the seed, and the post-planting management. If any one of those links of the chain is weak and breaks, then the whole thing falls apart. So there's a lot of possibilities here.
Bill in Oregon emailed to ask if there are any recommendations for removing Japanese parsley from an established prairie garden. Hopefully it hasn't reached your part of the state yet.
It reached my place 3 years ago, and I am beside myself. I don't know what to do. I'm pulling it. I pull it and pull it and pull it, and it seems to just like magically reappear. It's unbelievable. It is horrible. And I've got buckthorn. I've got honeysuckle. I've got porcelain. Excuse me. I've got Oriental bittersweet. I've got just about every doggone weed, but this stuff is totally driving me crazy. I don't know. And if anybody knows, please email me, neil@prairienursery.com. Tell me how to get rid of Japanese hedge nettle or parsley. It's absolutely driving me nuts.
Oh, yeah. That sounds awful.
It is awful.
Oh, my gosh. And Marcy emailed to ask, what's the best way to get orange butterfly weed in her established prairie?
To establish it in an established prairie,
yeah.
Best way to do that is to dig out an area 1 foot in diameter and remove all the vegetation, or she can go in and spray a 1 foot area with glyphosate to kill it, depending on how she wants to do this organically or not. Make sure there's plenty of room for the plant, and then to install the plant, usually the best time to install it would be May or early June. It's not really the best plant to put in the fall. Like so many plants are great in the fall. Butterfly weed is best put in the spring, late spring or in May or June. And make sure that she mulches it lightly around it to keep weeds down. You can use clean weed-free straw. You can use shredded hardwood. Don't put too much on. Make sure the soil can breathe. One of the mistakes people make is they put mulch on too thickly, and then they have a big mushroom pile and keeps it too wet. And butterfly weed hates wet, so you want to be super careful about how much mulch you put on there. But give it some room. Get rid of the vegetation around it so it can grow and have a little place to itself.
And in the last minute, Janine planted two areas of prairie seed in 2018, didn't do a good prep job. So now, 3 years later, they have dense Canada thistle, dense crown vetch, and bindweed, among other weeds. Should she just start over? These are a couple of areas, 10 by 30 each.
Surrender, earthling. Resistance is futile.
Yeah,
this is a start-over situation. And as I mentioned earlier, glyphosate is not going to kill those. You're going to have to go in there with triclopyr or aminopyrrolid, and drive for the field bindweed. So yeah, or smother it for 3 years if you want to do it organically. Because when you dig up field bindweed, it just spreads it all around, and the Canada thistle roots are 18 to 24 inches deep. So in crown vetch is just impossible. So yeah, I don't know how you got the trifecta there. You got the three worst herbaceous weeds possible. So you get the award of the Larry Mueller Show for the worst weeds. Oh my God, I thought I had it bad with Japanese hedge parsley. Okay, I feel better now.
Neil, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us. We'll look forward to another visit from you. Thanks, Neil.
You bet, Larry. It's always a pleasure to be with you. Thanks so much.
Neil DeBole, president of Prairie Nursery, a consulting ecologist and author of The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants. And by way of full disclosure, mention that Prairie Nursery is one of Wisconsin Public Radio's many business sponsors. Stay with us. Sharon Brock is up next, and he is an associate professor of soil science at UW-Stevens Point. Talk about how to tell if your soil is good, bad, or indifferent. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk. Stay with us. Great to have you along for Garden Talk today. You know, as gardeners, we tend to focus on what's above the ground and not the soil or plants not the soil or plants live in. Next up, we're going to talk about why soil is so important with our guest. Bryant Sharonbrock is an associate professor of soil science in the Soil and Waste Resources Department of the College of Natural Resources at the UW Stevens Point. So we'll talk with him about soil and get your questions as well. Love to have you join in. Number to call is 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Bryant Sharonbrock, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be on. I listen to the show quite regularly, and I'm really happy to be on and talk a little bit about soils.
Well, I tell you what, as a matter of fact, it was great. You sent us an email and said, you know, we're, in your experience, gardeners forget often about soil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they sure do. I think it tends to be one of these very important subjects, but also quite complex. But there are a lot of, you know, simple things that we can do to manage soil quality and work with the soils to help grow our plants and also provide and support the other functions that soils also give us.
So, you know, let's get everybody started on the same page. How do you define soil?
Oh, that's a great question. So first off, I would say that soil is not dirt. So I do distinguish soil from dirt. And there's some things that I think are important when we consider a definition of soil. First is that it's a natural living being. It's composed of organic matter, but it also has this mineral component of sand, silt, and clay. It has air. It has water. It is very complex, which is another thing that I use to define it. It has physical, chemical, and biological properties. And all of these things are working together to provide very important functions for us, like water storage and cleaning, like a habitat for soil organisms, even the plant, the buildings and infrastructure. It recycles all of our waste, it modifies our atmosphere, and of course we grow our plants in it, and that's probably the most relevant for your audience. Other things when we think about a definition of soil that I point out is it's really the interface between all of the water, the air, the rocks, and the living organisms on our planet. And it's not just this static interface, it's dynamic, meaning that it changes over time, it changes across space, it changes with depth. And then the last thing I always like to emphasize this in a definition of soil is that it's fragile. I think that's something that folks will forget. You know, it's underneath our feet, we're walking on it all the time, and we think it's this resource that we can do whatever to, and it's just going to continue providing the services, but that's really not the case. We can damage soil quality in a matter of seconds by driving on it at the wrong time. And that can take thousands of years to repair. So yeah, so that's my definition of soil. I know it's a little bit long winded, but it's definitely not dirt.
So what's dirt?
So for me, it really depends on the person. So for me, there's very few things I would consider dirt, but dirt is more of a nuisance. So even the stuff that's underneath my fingernails, I appreciate it supporting life. I don't mind it. I consider the distinction being something that's a nuisance.
How'd you get interested in soil, by the way?
So I started off as more of a plant person. I still am a plant person. I have degrees in forestry and I study tree and soil interactions, but I started digging some soil pits and looking at soils, particularly this was up in the upper Michigan underneath some of those old growth forests, northern hardwood hemlocks, and saw these spectacular soil horizons where they have this accumulation of iron and aluminum and so much so that it cements up. And then so much that cementing works with the forest and creating these restrictive layers, and that works to make the trees tip over. And this really cool, complex feedback loop was kind of presented to me. And after that, I was hooked. I just can't stop digging holes. I dig them all the time. And yeah, every time you dig a hole, you get to go back thousands and sometimes even millions of years in history. And really put together the landscape. So it's just amazing for me.
As you were talking about that and your definition of soil, I was thinking of a great soil scientist from the University of Wisconsin, Francis Hole.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And he would teach his classes. He'd take his violin to his class.
Would. Yep.
And so this is what sandy soil sounds like. And this is what Antigo silt loam sounds like. And just the varying notes and tones within the music kind of gives you, as you were explaining that, I was thinking about his playing and how that kind of worked for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know, Larry, do you know the Antigo song? So Francis came up with the state soil song, which is the Antigo song. And it's a beautiful song, but yeah, Y'all should Google it if you don't. Yeah.
His home, actually, where he lived his life here at the UW, he's passed, of course, along a bit, is only a block behind my own house. So I walk by it pretty much every day and think about him. He's a pretty cool guy. So the plants we put into it, it's so important to the plants we put into it, and depending on the soil itself, it makes a difference to the plants that you want to put in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, one of the principles of soil management, and this is probably the most important principle in my opinion, is this idea of the right plant for the right soil. There's thousands and thousands of different types of soils out there, and there's also thousands and thousands of different types of plants with all different tolerances for different soil conditions. And you know, oftentimes soil management is focused on like, what can we do to fix the soil and fix in quotation marks? But, you know, another approach we could take is, what can we do to match the plants with the existing soil conditions? And we can learn a lot about this just by looking at the natural plant communities and looking at and studying the soils that are associated with these natural plant communities, and then try to mimic these soils for the target plants. So, for example, if I want to grow a red pine forest, you know, I know that I would want maybe a sandy, more acidic soil compared to if I was going to grow a forest with sugar maple. Maybe I want to do some syruping. Well, then I would maybe want to have a more fine textured soil, a layer with maybe some clay accumulation, a little bit more fertility. So I think a lot can be done by understanding the plant and soil relationships.
Yeah. A lot of that came up in our the first segment of our program with Neil DeBoe. Many people were talking.
Yeah.
Neil was quick to point out if people ask if people had what kind of soil they had, and they'd give kind of a description, and then he would sometimes disagree with them based on what they said. But mostly he would say, well, you can't grow these plants here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was listening along. It was excellent. I particularly like some of the recommendations about some of those wet, more fine textured soils and plants like sensitive fern. That's just excellent advice. I mean, why work against these soil conditions? Instead, we can embrace the plants that are going to really succeed in those environments.
Yeah, absolutely. Brian Scherenbrock, our guest today, Associate Professor of Soil Science at UW Stevens Point. We're talking about soils and plants and their relationships. Maybe you've got a question, maybe about plants that might or might not work in your soil, or maybe you have a question about the soil itself, or a little more about an individual type of soil that you do have. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News and Garden Talk. Talking soil and the plants and their relationship with our guest, Brian Scherenbrock, Associate Professor of Soil Science at UW Stevens Point. Great to have him with us. And again, you can join in at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Let's talk about finding out about your soil. There are, you know, probably what's the best way for the average person to find out about their soil?
Oh, yeah. So how can you tell if your soil is good, bad, or somewhere in between? I think you want to start with first, what are you using your soil for? There's many different functions that soils perform. Are you growing corn on it? Is it a forest soil? Are you using it for a septic system? So that will define a little bit about some of the indicators that you would focus in on, these kind of clues that'll tell you about soil quality. I think for your audience, you're mostly going to be interested in growing plants and garden plants in particular. So there are a handful of physical, chemical, and biological indicators that folks will look for soil quality for these purposes. So for example, looking at the soil structure, and those are these little clumps of soil, how the sand, silt, clay, and organic matter are held together. And that's one of my favorite indicators. And what you're looking for is this crumbly granular structure that looks like a bunch of BBs all the way to marbles. And that's there because of the high organic matter and essentially the gluing of the sand, silt, and clay together in those little balls. And that indicates a lot of biological activity, both in plants and microorganisms. And that's ideal because it's going to allow for the water to drain out of the soil and also the water to be held in the soil. So that's a really great physical indicator. An example of a biological indicator, organic matter is so important for soil quality. So if we can look at the soil to assess how much organic matter is in it, if it has a dark color, if it has that organic smell compared to like an anaerobic or sour smell, if it has that sort of, I always say like a 70% chocolate bar color, that's kind of what we're looking for, that brownish color. And then, of course, you know, the plants growing in there, you don't forget about them. They're living in that environment. So if you see great, vigorous plant growth, that's one of our best indicators of soil quality. Other animals like earthworms and fungi. And sometimes we have chemical indicators. Those tend to be a little bit more difficult to assess. And oftentimes folks will collect soil samples and then send them off a laboratory for that. But there are some simple tests like assessing the soil pH, which you can do from things like garden kits that can give you some loose approximations about your soil acidity, alkalinity.
We have Dean in Iron River with a question. Let's go there. Hi, Dean. Thank you for calling.
Your soil acidity, alkalinity.
We have Dean in Iron River with a question.
Dean, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good afternoon. I had a question. I'm growing pumpkins up in Iron River. I'm just wondering, somebody told me like pumpkins grow better in like a sandier content soil, or I don't know what that means, but was wondering if you had anything to say about that.
I don't know a lot about pumpkins in particular and soil preferences. What kind of soil do you have? Are you aware? Is it more of a sandy soil?
It's not very sandy. It's very thick. It's right near like a wetland. And okay. It's been farmed for decades by my father, but I've taken it over. And so it's sort of very moist, low. I don't know how to talk about
it. Yeah. Have you tried growing pumpkins on it so far?
I have. And I've gotten a pretty good crop this year. I'm just wondering whether or not can make it better.
They do prefer a more drained soil, which is why folks will say the sandier soils. And if you do have a higher water table, one of the things that you could look to do is maybe mound it up a little bit. So take some of that soil and create, a one, two, 3 foot mound. That's actually how I grow my pumpkins as well, too, just because of that drainage issue. You could add a little bit of organic matter if your soil looks light in color. Applying a little compost might be a good strategy for that.
Yeah, for sure. But I like the idea of hilling for sure. That will make a difference, I would think, Dean. Mm-hmm. Give it a shot. Let's go to Karen in Black River. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I have a barnyard area, and I have this one area where it has had a lot of manure on it in past years, but it's been a while. The soil is just super dark, rich black, but it's a pretty big section, maybe 20 by 30, and it's wet all the time, like constantly. I'm just mm-hmm. wondering if the way to figure out if there's a spring or something underneath there, how would I...
So how would you go about determining if there's a spring or something under that area? Is that your question, Karen?
Yeah. Like, who do I even call about that?
When you look outside of the manure affected area, what does that area look like?
Oh, that's just all dry and sandy. And the rest of the barnyard's all nice and clean and sandy. And and there hasn't been manure on that area for many years. But it's just, and every place else is dry. I live, the horses are up on a hill, so I have fantastic drainage. And it doesn't always get the best sun to dry it out, but it gets enough that it should not be wet, like every single day, every single year.
So organic matter is really great, but when you have so much, it really holds on to water. And if I, what you're describing sounds to me like you just have a lot of manure in that particular soil. One thing I would suggest doing is, you know, when you expose organic matter to the air, it'll start to decompose. And you could till that area, and that will work to oxidize some of that organic matter. And then over time, it would probably become, it would reduce the water holding capacity and dry it out a little bit. That's what I would try to start with. You might even just dig in with a shovel to see how deep it is. Because if it's, you know, if we're talking about really thick organic horizons that are 2-3 feet deep, that's, that might take a little bit more work to do what I'm describing.
Yeah. So get the shovel out and see. And so if it's a foot or less, Brian?
Yep. I think you could till that up. And you might have to hit it a couple times, but then it would work to decompose that.
All right. There you go, Karen. Thank you so much for calling. Jonathan in Fitchburg has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Jonathan.
Hello. So this might be a really technical question. I've been reading a lot about microplastics and, you know, how they're working our, their way into us via our food and the environment in general. And I just wasn't, I was curious if that's something that you're studying with soils and if it's getting to us through our food that we grow in soil, or if that's not really something that, not that we need to worry about, or if it's just not an issue with plants as much as it is with, you know, like fish have tons of microplastics.
Yeah,
that's a great question. So microplastics would fall into categories of these sort of toxic things that, that we can be exposed to, either directly or indirectly through soils and plants. And folks are studying it. It's a relatively new area of study in soil science, obviously, because it's a relatively new sort of issue in our society. And they are studying things like, are these things being taken up into plants? Are they decomposing? If they're decomposing, what sort of organisms are involved in their decomposition? And then where are these products going? Are they going into our waters and to our wherever they're ending up? It's not something that I myself am studying. I study urban soils and I study more the toxins. I focus in on are heavy metals, and we started studying a little bit on PFAS as well too. So I can't speak towards the specifics on it other than to say that folks are definitely looking into it and it's research that's happening.
All right, Jonathan, thank you so much for calling. Jan in Viroqua, your turn. Hi, Jan.
Hi. Last year in the fall, I put down cardboard on my vegetable garden and put on a layer of about 6 inches of lasagna guarding, primarily fresh vegetable scraps. And I did not see a noticeable improvement this summer, and I was wondering would it be better to put down a couple of inches of manure, composted manure across the whole thing. Mm-hmm.
What do you think, Brian?
Yeah, can I ask what are you growing? What plants are you trying to target?
Crucifers mostly in that area.
Okay.
And have you looked at your soil prior to? Did it have a topsoil horizon that was darker in color? And if it did, how approximately how big was that?
I have some of the best soil in Viroqua. It used to be a cattle farm.
Yeah,
so I have really good, and it's been organic for over 20 years.
Oh, excellent. So the cardboard, you know, that's for weeds, and I'm assuming you were able to take care of the weeds with that, and you don't have a problem with that. The addition of the manure I mean, I don't, from what you're describing, it doesn't sound like that might be necessary because you have such a high organic matter soil already. I look at organic matter management a little bit like you would do your checkbook. Consider like the outputs, and that would be the nutrients that are associated with the plants that are being taken out, and the inputs would be like my income and the incoming organic matter that might be the plants left on site, or if we do had to add something to it. And it sounds like you have a pretty big balance in your checkbook already, so you might not need to add a lot of organic matter until you start depleting it.
So do a little depleting before you do a little adding there.
Maybe because if you keep adding it, you could run into a situation like the previous or a couple callers ago where you have this really high organic matter that can hold on to a little bit too much water, maybe not as strong as a medium in terms of its support. So we want to target about 5 to 10% maximum organic matter in most mineral soils for plants.
Thinking about that, Lori emailed that she has jumping worms and they left the soil looking like coffee grounds and hard to get rid of the worms. Anything she can do to improve the soil. Of course, if you do that, you just keep the worms coming.
The worms, the jumping worms and the night crawlers, boy, that's an issue that we have in some of our Wisconsin forests and even some of our managed areas now. They really rip through that organic matter layer. There's some active research looking at things like charcoal, and because they can be irritants for the earthworms. I would certainly continue to add the organic matter because you don't want that all depleted. One thing, if it's not a really large area, you can use extractants. So one of the ways that we study earthworms is by using mustard powder. So we mix up mustard powder with water and we pour that on soil. And it's an irritant for their skin, but it's not a very dangerous one for the environment. And they'll come up and then you could gather them physically and remove them from a site if it's not a large area. Other ways that you can get them out of the soil is vibrations. So sounding rods folks will put in the ground and pound it and put them up or gather them on wet periods. So if it's a large area, then that's a different story. It's really hard to get them out, yeah.
It is indeed. I like that mustard idea, though. I hadn't heard that.
Oh, yeah, it's cool. When we teach kids about soil quality, earthworms are so charismatic. And when a bunch of kids are standing around, we pour some mustard liquid on the soil and they see all the worms coming up. Oh, they go crazy. And so do the adults, especially the soil scientist adults like myself.
And you're talking about dry mustard like we got in our kitchens.
Oh, yeah. You want to get it's better to use the spicier, the better. It's the compound, the glucosinolate in the mustard powder itself is the irritant.
Yeah. Well, this has been interesting and fun, Brian. I thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Maybe we can do this again down the road. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Thank you very much. I'd love to do it again and appreciate the time. And thank you for having me on the show.
Our guest, Brian Scherenbrock. And I tell you what, I think our technical director today, Jeff Robbins, dug up a copy of the Antigo Silt Loam song, so we can go out on that. I want to thank you all for listening. Brian, of course, again, associate professor at UW-Stevens Point in the Department of Soil Science. Great to have him with us. And I mentioned, along with Jeff Robbins, Lee Rayburn's our other technical director, Clara Neiper, Joel Patnut, our producers, Jill Nadeau, our executive producer, our director, and I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening, and let's listen to a couple of seconds of the Antigo Silt Loam song.